We are breaking down all aspects of Yankee baseball. This is the Bronx Pinstripe Show with your host, Andrew Rotondi and Scott Reinen. Let's go.
Sanchez crushes one to left center. There it goes. See ya. His first big league home run. A bomb. And the Yankees lead 7-4.
Bueno, me siento emocionante, feliz de que di mi primer jonrón y...
Yeah, it's definitely a nice feeling to hit your first home run in the big leagues, and I'm hoping to hit more.
That one's driven deep to left field. Going back is Franklin. Track, wall, see ya! A long home run for Sanchez. A two-run blast.
The Yankees have to see everything about Sanchez to see if they're going to be their number one guy. Here's the payoff. Swung on and into the air to left center and deep. Up and going back, away back to the track, to the wall. She's gone! Into the visitor's bullpen. I'm telling you, Gary Sanchez has a chance to be a big player.
Oh, driven deep to left field. There it goes! See ya! A long home run into the second deck and left. A three-run blast. His second home run of the night. He is the youngest Yankee to start in the cleanup spot since Jay Buhner did it. And he hits a deep fly ball to center. Turning, looking, see ya! A home run into Monument Park. Gary Sanchez is serious about this. Five home runs.
Sanchez licks that in the air to left and deep. That ball is gone! Sanchez cranks that deep left, and Gary Sanchez has done it again! Sanchez crushes that deep left center field, and that ball is gone! Gary Sanchez continues to amaze! Are you kidding me? Gary Sanchez delivers that deep to left, and Sanchez again with a bomb! This monster keeps eating! Home run number 9 for Sanchez, and he went upper tank on that one.
Sanchez has singled, doubled in two, then grounded out. So if he makes out, that'll be twice in a row, and he'll probably be sent down. And here's the 1-0. Swung on and into the air to deep left field. It is high. It is far. It is gone. Amazing. Stupendous. Fabulous. I have no other words.
Gary Sanchez is coming up, and the 1-2. Driven out to right center. That ball is gone. He's done it again. Gary Sanchez goes yard. His 11th home run of the year. This magical month continues.
What's up, everyone? Welcome to the Bronx Pinstripe Show, episode 92. You just heard all 11 of Gary Sanchez's home runs so far this year. And Scott, it might even be more because we're recording before Sunday's game. Who knows? He could have four home runs this afternoon.
It's pretty hard to keep up at this point because this kid is just on another planet. Every single time, I'm completely disappointed if he comes up and doesn't hit a home run at this point. That's where we are with this kid. But unbelievable. How, I mean, can you even possibly imagine a start like this for Sanchez? And, you know, this wasn't even the guy that we were, I think, most excited for, you know, when all these kids came up and started talking about. So the fact that this dude has just taken New York by storm is unbelievable. And he's literally carried the Yankees, you know, over the past 2 weeks.
Well, yeah, it's like yesterday in that 12-4 ball game. Everyone was sticking around the stadium for one more Gary Sanchez at bat, and then Joe Girardi drops Austin Romine in there to pinch hit. I'm sure everyone was pretty happy about that aspect, but you're absolutely right. Gary Sanchez has carried the Yankees, and for number 92, this little tidbit came from Neil Keefe, who has been on this show before. Says 1992 was the last time the Yankees finished a season below 500. And this season, I think you and I thought there was a real possibility about a month ago for that to happen again. But this last month of baseball has been exciting. They've been playing well. They're 12-8 in their last 20. And since Gary Sanchez started going on a home run barrage, they are 10-5 in the last 15 games. So you're absolutely right that he is the catalyst for this team. They are now scoring about a run more per game since he came into the lineup. And there's just no words to describe how good he's been and the type of difference maker he's been for this team.
Yeah, he's been tremendous. And, you know, I keep getting lumped into all of the pessimistic calls and negativity around this team, but I'm pretty sure that I predicted this team to be above 500. And for when the kids come up, then the, you know, all the veterans would start stepping their game up. This is something that I actually saw. This is a vision. I had tunnel vision and saw this. I saw Gary Sanchez hitting 11 home runs in 20 games. Right. It was, yeah, that I dreamt about that.
I saw you chirping me on Twitter yesterday that you predicted that. It's a little easy to only remember the predictions that come true.
Of course. Why would I remember the ones that fall by the wayside?
I think we make about six or seven predictions each podcast that most likely don't come true.
But the underlying theme of the fact that these kids are starting to play really well and just have some that energy, that's the biggest thing. It's not even that they were, I mean, nobody could have predicted this, obviously. It's impossible to predict something like this. But the fact that the kids are bringing just a level of energy and excitement to the diamond and the fans in the stadium, you can see it in the vets and all the veteran players. I mean, they're actually starting to play better. It seems like they're caring more, if that's even fair. I don't know if it is or not, but it looks like they are, and it looks like they're having a lot more fun. So I credit Gary Sanchez. I credit Judge and Romine and like all the guys that are coming up and just feeding into this positivity, this beautifulness that's going on in the dugout. I love it.
One guy that doesn't look quite dead, even though he looked dead for the entire season, was Mark Teixeira, who's starting to come around a little bit with 5 weeks to go in his major league career.
And he's got nothing to lose, right?
That is the El Gary, I am Gary effect, which is what he hashtags all of his tweets with, which is just cocky as hell, and I love it so much. Some more insane stats from Gary Sanchez. He is the fastest player ever in Major League Baseball history to 11 home runs, and it's taken him 23 games. But you think about the fact that his first 9 career games, if you date back to last year, 2 games, and then his first 7 of this year, he did not hit a home run. So in 15 games, he's hit 11 home runs, which is a 119 home runs per season pace.
He's going to blow it out of the water. We're gonna start tracking this.
Barry Bonds, he's coming for that ass.
Yeah, the dude's been unbelievable, and it's pretty amazing when he came back up. You know, the fury that he's come into the Bronx with after, I guess, a slow start the first time he came up. He definitely looks like a completely different player. So good on Sanchez, man, taking advantage of this opportunity, and it's fun to watch. It really is. You can't look away when he's coming up to bat.
He has joined Mickey Mantle and Joe DiMaggio. I don't know if you've ever heard of those guys, but they're pretty good, pretty important as far as Yankees and Major League Baseball history goes. But he joins them as the only players of 23 or younger to hit at least 11 home runs in a month, and there's still a couple days left in this month. And he is the second fastest ever behind DiMaggio in Yankees history to 30 hits. So it's not just hyperbole when we talk about Gary Sanchez and how well he's playing. He's literally making baseball history.
It's funny because I talk a little bit of smack to a couple of buddies that I went to school with that are Orioles fans, and you know, just talking about this series coming into the weekend, how big it was, because this series with the Orioles, obviously, if we are to sweep this, we're recording in the morning on Sunday, so the game hasn't been played yet. But if the Yankees were to go in and sweep this game, it's a different element to, you know, where they are in the standings, whereas if they were to get their butts whooped this weekend, they would pretty much get buried by the Orioles. So the fact that that was such a potential of the Yankees actually climbing back into this, everybody was talking about, these guys were like, you know, well, I'm just glad Sanchez has gotten off such a hot start, because this is exactly when he's going to cool down. This is the time he's going to come back down to earth. And this dude is unconscious.
How the hell are the Orioles so good this year with that pitching staff?
The pitching staff is bad.
It is the worst thing I've ever seen. I understand their offense is stupid good. I mean, they've got Trumbo, Chris Davis, and Manny Machado all have 30-plus home runs, and I think I saw 70-plus RBIs or 65-plus RBIs for all those guys. I mean, it's insane what their lineup can do, but God, their pitching staff is bad.
Yeah, and Bundy had a bad start against us. He had pitched well before that.
He's been one of their most consistent starters. And I know their bullpen has been pretty locked down.
Well, Britton's one of the best in the league.
He's had one of the best seasons for a relief pitcher in history. which I understand. I mean, when they're mashing the ball and then you get into a close, you don't want to get into a close game late with them because they can hit home runs and they've got a shutdown closer. But that starting rotation is just so damn bad. I don't know how they're in first place or have been hovering around first place the whole season.
Yeah, it's funny because when you look at that and you're looking at that dominant closer in the background, it sounds like a very similar story.
Yeah, haven't we heard that? Haven't we?
you got to get to that guy first for him to be effective.
Well, the difference is they mashed the ball, and the Yankees did not hit for 3+ months this year.
Which almost makes it even more impressive to look at where we are right now and the fact that we are still within, a stone's throw of them, because the offense has been so inconsistent, and then all of a sudden these kids come up and it just gets better because Gary Sanchez is the best pitcher, or the best hitter in baseball.
I bet he'd be the best pitcher too.
He probably would be. He's the best catcher. He's unbelievable.
So
the fact that he's throwing these guys out with just such ease, you can't run on him.
What does that make, 6 of 8 or 6 of 9?
He's unbelievable.
Yeah. The beautiful thing about it is that once you get the reputation as a catcher, as somebody who can throw runners out, then they stop running on you altogether, which is even better than throwing runners out because then they don't try. And I understand that a lot of it has to do with the pitchers. I mean, right. The main aspect of stealing a base, you don't really steal on the catcher most of the time. You steal on the pitcher. I mean, there's certain circumstances where if the catcher bobbles the ball or whatever it may be, or Mike Piazza, who could barely throw it 70 miles an hour down to second base, then you might steal on the catcher. But your average major league catcher has a decent arm. He's going to get the ball down there in a couple seconds. You steal on the pitcher. But if they're scared shitless that Gary Sanchez has a rifle and he's going to throw him out or pick him off, he's not afraid of his arm to throw down to second base to try and pick somebody off or first base, that's even better to shut down the running game.
Yeah, it's like having a shutdown corner in the NFL. You don't throw to that side if you know a guy's going to be blanketed, so they don't get that many balls thrown at them. It's a similar scenario. I think he was clocked at 1.8 to second base yesterday. I mean, the kid's – he's got – and the unbelievable thing to me is a couple of these balls have been, not great balls to throw on. I mean, he gets his feet set so fast and has such a quick release.
It's
nothing that I expected. Nothing that I expected. Where were all the scouts talking about this?
It's a fast throw, but it's accurate. It's always right on the bag in a good position to slap a tag, and that's almost more important than how fast you throw it. If you throw it in the general zone of where the guy's going to be stealing or going to be sliding, it's right there. You don't have to do the extra motion. Didi or Castro doesn't have to do the extra motion to tag him. So you're right. Why the hell did we not hear about how good this guy's arm was?
Let's just combine all of these things: accuracy, good feet behind the plate, an absolute cannon, and put them all into Algieri. And there you go. You have the perfect baseball player.
He's not going to be this good for the rest of the year or the rest of his.
But, why did you be so negative?
No, I'm not being negative. I'm trying to make a point here.
I know.
But he hit 99 career home runs in the major leagues, which is good. He's played in the minor leagues a long time. He was signed as an
99 in the minor leagues.
What did
I
say?
You said majors.
Well, he's on pace for 99.
You're just foreshadowing for like the 40th game.
I don't know if you were listening to Boomer and Carton this week, but I know Carton was kind of trolling, but he was like, if Gary Sanchez keeps this up, he's got to win Rookie of the Year and MVP. And I don't disagree with him.
Oh, God. If the Yankees make the playoffs, then...
There's no game minimum. He's not going to win MVP because baseball writers won't vote for him.
Right.
But there's no minimum. You don't have to qualify for the MVP. You can vote for anybody.
Same with Rookie of the Year, right? There's no qualification?
No, there is qualifications with Rookie of the Year because you have to qualify as a rookie.
Oh, yes. Okay. Well, he will, right? No, he may not.
I don't know if he does.
It'll be close.
I think you have to play, I think it's 60 games. I don't know if he's going to reach that. He's not going to reach that. I think he's only going to reach like 50 games. But what I would say, if he finishes the season at 30 home runs.
Oh, come on.
He's 30 home runs and the Yankees make the playoffs and he's batting like .375. Hell yeah, he deserves to be the MVP.
Yeah. Hey, if he does that, then we will start a giant campaign. The Twitter sphere will be going bonkers over MVP Algieri.
But I don't even remember what I was talking about. But yeah, I mean, it's the electricity that he's brought to the team. And it's funny, I was making that home run montage that you guys listened to, and I listened to all those calls by the radio announcers and Michael Kay, and what's the guy's name that does the West Coast games?
Ryan Rucco.
He's pretty good, actually.
He is pretty good. I like him.
When Yes sends their B squad out to the West Coast,
it's a long trip, man. Yeah, I'm sure it's in the contract.
Well, I know Michael Kay never wants to go to Oakland, which I don't blame him, but Seattle's a nice place to visit in the summer.
Yeah.
But they were at a loss for words. When you watch a guy making baseball history, it's like, what do you say about him at a certain point? He hit another home run. I can't believe it. He hit another home run.
Yeah, it's, you start running out of phrases, or you just have to just go with pure excitement, I think, at that point, because you're almost becoming the announcers have to. I mean, they're in a position where they're watching this team every day, and you see a guy that gets off to such a hot start like that, you just got to sit back and enjoy it and be a fan almost at that point, and just have, you know, complete passion and exuberance in your call, because that's what it is. There's no other way to do it, in my opinion.
And Elgarry is kind of taking the baseball world by storm. You see he signed with Steiner Sports.
I did. And Teixeira was with him before Teixeira had that big game.
I'm telling you, he's rubbing off on people.
Yep.
He's going to start to spread around the league. And obviously, he's going to come back down to earth a little bit. But he's one of the biggest storylines already in this season for baseball. So it's pretty
crazy. Doubt. I mean, the fact that he's doing it with the Yankees right now and they're climbing back into a race that most people thought they were out of is pretty tremendous. And yes, he's starting to make the headlines. His highlights are being stacked at the top of all these highlight shows now.
And he tweeted, I believe we talked about this last week, I can't remember, but he tweeted that we might just be young and dumb enough to do this thing.
Yep. You know, I want to talk about that, because I appreciate the players that engage on social media now, and the ones that come, because Didi's been doing it. I think, I don't know if he was doing it last year. I think he was, but after every game, he goes on and just tweets something about the game and about who did well and, you know, whatever. And I appreciate that, because he goes on and just says something to everybody. He's acknowledging that the fans are there and that they're on social media and on Twitter. And Sanchez has been doing the same thing. And I really like that, because one, first of all, it's a really awesome way for you to get a ridiculous amount of fans behind you. And two, it's just, I don't know, you feel more engaged with the team when these guys are talking almost directly. It feels directly to you as a fan base. So,
well, do you think it's actually Sanchez?
I think he's there. Yeah, yeah. Well, maybe his that guy who does all the
I believe
the translating,
because
is doing it.
I don't know. I mean, I'm sure he can speak English conversationally and just doesn't want to do it in interviews, because he has been in the U.S. since he's 16 years old and he's 23. You figure he picked up on some English. But I mean, even Ichiro doesn't do interviews in English, and he's been here for 16 years, and I know he can speak pretty good English.
A lot of that is tactical, you were talking about.
You don't want to
do a million interviews,
and you don't want to also fumble over your words or sound stupid or whatever it may be. But he does tweet in both Spanish and English, and something tells me he's not the one actually tweeting.
Well, and that's fine. I mean, he's probably dictating what's happening. You know what I mean?
Yes.
I've been behind the scenes of like an athlete social media campaign, and I know that there's usually a team of people around him, and it kind of has to be that way. You know, it's a lot of the time it is the athlete. A lot of the time it's maybe someone that's doing it for them, but coming from them. So it doesn't matter. To me, it's his sentiment, and it's coming from him. So and I think Didi actually does tweet.
Yes, and Didi does those Instagram videos. He's very engaging. Didi's got the personality for New York. That's for damn sure.
Yes, he does.
I think he's turned into a leader on this team. And I think if you think about this last month of baseball and where the Yankees were a month ago, they were getting swept in Tampa right before the trade deadline. You remember how bad that was? That was basically the nail in the coffin for the season. Now we're going to trade our players, which you and I were totally fine with. That's what we wanted them to do. But you fast forward a month, and Gary Sanchez is carrying the team. You've got Aaron Judge and Tyler Austin on the squad. Sessa and Green are pitching well. Didi and Starlin are doing their damn thing. And they're also in the middle of the lineup carrying the team.
Second half Starlin.
Gary Sanchez is getting all the glory, which obvious. It's that's clear. I mean, of course he is. But Starlin Castro's had a huge month as well.
Starlin Castro has been on fire, and this is the second year in a row where you hit the All-Star break, and apparently he just hits the on button, and he was in cruise control the first half because, I mean, he did get off to a hell of
a
start.
He was hot in April, and he actually had a very bad May.
Right, and now after the All-Star break, and he comes out of the gate, I mean, this dude is on fire right now, and he's hitting with power. What does he have, 18, 19 home runs, career highs?
He's got a career high in home runs.
Went 4-for-4 the other night.
Both him and Didi each have at least 15 home runs and I think at least 60 RBIs. Not bad for a double play combination, especially two guys that were playing in an offense that stumbled over themselves for 3 months of the year.
And the interesting thing about Castro, talking about him, I know we've kind of just transitioned into a Castro conversation, but. You know, we were talking about when we discuss all the prospects and the middle infielders, and everybody's like, oh my God, why do the Yankees have so many middle infielders? They already have two guys that are doing well in the majors. Well, this is I think, supporting both what you and I thought. The fact that he's adding more power as he's getting older, or, you know, in Yankee Stadium, it's just more of a power play for him as well, just supports the fact that I think he's going to be the third baseman at some point. I think he's going to slide over. His body type looks more like a third baseman. And the fact that he's played shortstop in the past, you know, he could seemingly make that transition pretty quick from second and short to third base. And the fact that he's adding the power is making him more of a prototypical corner guy. And I think that's his future. And these middle infielders are going to be fighting for a spot because I don't think Didi's going anywhere. I think Didi is going to be the shortstop for a long time. And as well, he should be because he's playing his butt off.
Well, that transitions perfectly to the third baseman that has been bitching a little bit about his playing time, Chase Headley. On the road trip on the West Coast, Chase Headley only played on two games, two of the six games, and he went 1-for-8. And he was battling a little bit of an injury. I think he had a sore Achilles heel. Torres was on fire, 9-for-16, hit his first career home run. And you could kind of see the writing on the wall that Girardi was playing Torres over Headley. And Headley didn't outright complain about his playing time, but he sort of alluded to it in some of the comments he made, where he's made comments to the media that, of course, I'm upset I'm not in there. I haven't spoken to Joe Girardi about why I'm not playing, so I'm assuming I'm the starting third baseman. And then the Yankees go back home, and Headley still is not the starting third baseman. He played DH, but that was only because Brian McCann was home for a death in the family. So it looks like Chase Headley has been benched, and I am ecstatic.
Well, I'm going to play the other side of this real quick because I know where you are. I think everybody in the world knows where you are on this Chase Headley topic. The fact is that when he's talking about this stuff, like you said, he didn't really come out directly and complain about this. He's getting fired questions by the media and he's answering these questions. So he's probably getting direct questions about, oh, have you spoken with Joe? Oh, how do you feel the fact that you're not starting? Oh, why aren't you starting? He's coming out with these answers. I mean, he's being honest saying, yeah, I want to start. Of course I want to start. No, I haven't talked to Joe. So it's not like him coming out and saying, hey guys, come over here. Come to my locker. I got something to say about not playing at
that's
base.
How it
come
went
here.
Down in my head.
No, yeah, exactly.
He held up. He had a megaphone. He had a blow. He got everyone's attention. I need to complain about something. Please come
this
here.
This guy doesn't say three words all season. I mean, he's very quiet. You don't hear anything from him. I mean, through ups and downs, you don't hear anything from him in the media or on the field. You don't hear anything from him vocally. Anyway, the Torres kid that comes out and just starts banging. I mean, he had his first major league home run. He was super hot. Girardi's riding that as long as he can. And I think at this point, Girardi knows that he needs to ride every hot hand that's out there. So he's not worried about it. And I do think that there is writing on the wall for what's happening with this team, that Headley's not going to be a part of it long term.
Absolutely.
So there's that. Listen, I don't know what his immediate is about next year. He probably will be on the team next year just because of the contract.
Yeah.
But there's definitely the writing on the wall for what's going to happen into the future. And he's definitely not in the plans. That's for sure.
Listen, Torres.
But he came back out and hit a home run when he hit DH too.
Torres is not the future third baseman of the Yankees. You and I agree on that.
Yes.
Like you just said, Starlin Castro has a chance to move over there. There's plenty of guys in the minors that they could, if they want to, transition over to third base. They've got Tyler Austin, who could play third base. A lot of guys could play third base over Torres. But he is a 23-year-old kid who plays good defense, and right now he's hitting. So you absolutely have to ride that. Girardi is every bit justified to be doing that over the veteran who's making a lot of money. But you're right. Chase Headley, two more seasons at $13 million per It's a lot of cash. The Yankees are already going to be eating $20-plus million for A-Rod. If they do trade Brian McCann, they're going to have to eat some money for him. It's going to take a lot if they want to eat some money for Chase Headley as well. But I would be absolutely shocked if in 2018, so after next year, Chase Headley is still the starting third baseman. That, to me, just does not seem like a possibility at this point.
No, I think next year is going to be his last year in pinstripes. I think he's going to – unless he has a tremendous year and just they'll stick with him for the last year of the contract, but I don't see it happening. I don't see them sticking with him past next year. And, you know, I think he's going to be on a short leash next year too. So
And if you're Chase Headley, you only have to look in the mirror and blame yourself for why you're not playing. He had 120-plus games to perform, and he did not really perform. If he was hitting even at his career levels, which is not great by any means, but is least respectable, Girardi would play him, no questions asked. Don't you agree?
Yes, and to be fair to Headley, after that horrible, horrible, horrible start, I mean, the guy's been a pretty steady major leaguer over at third. He's not anything crazy, I know, but his numbers are a lot better than that start. I mean, he was buried.
You couldn't be any worse than he started. He didn't have an extra base hit for a month and a half.
I know.
But if you, from the day he got his first extra base hit until today, he's still a below average third baseman in the league as far as offensive production goes.
It is what it is. We know what he is. I think at this point, we know what he is. He's not that guy that had that monster season in San Diego.
That's a little fishy, right?
That was a beautiful
smells
contract
a little bit
here.
Like Brady Anderson.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know what they do out on the West Coast. There are a lot of holistic things going on out there. But the fact that he had that big year, people thought he was going to come over and you know, duplicate those numbers, and it just hasn't been the case. So this is a guy that's not going to be on the team long term. He's going to be on a short leash, and I think he understands what's going on right now. The fact that he's answering these questions, honestly, you know, I have no problem with that. I don't think he was really going out trying to make headlines.
Oh, I think he was sticking it right to Girardi.
Of course you do.
Last thing I'll say about the Chase Headley situation is that look at what they've done with Brian McCann and Mark Teixeira. They're no longer the everyday players, and Chase Headley is the third in that veteran list, and I have no problem with it. And I think it's absolutely the right move at this point in time. You gotta ride the energy of this team.
Real quick, the more and more I'm seeing Brian McCann as this DH leader in the clubhouse guy, the more and more I'm kind of liking that situation and his role on the team, to tell you the truth.
Yeah, we talked about it last week, and I believe we kind of both agree that if being an everyday DH and catching maybe once a week boosts his offensive production, then we're both completely on board with having him be the DH next year.
And the fact that all these kids are going to be up, I mean, you need these leaders who have been around, the veteran guys who have been around for a long time. I think that's an integral part of a team, an integral part of a dugout. I think it helps limit slumps. It gets people, you know, better scouting reports. Obviously, him being a catcher, he's seen a lot of different players in this league. I think he can really help out the young guys in this team, and I think you need that type of guy in the clubhouse. And we can't get rid of everybody. I don't think Headley's that guy who comes around and you know, he's a leader, will talk and coach you up. I don't think he's that guy at all. You look around, there aren't very many of those guys. I don't even think Ellsbury's that guy. I could see Gardner being that guy. I don't think Gardner's even in the team next year.
I don't think Ellsbury speaks in the clubhouse. I think he goes in, changes, showers up, and goes home. I honestly don't think he says a word.
Yeah. Didi and Castro, I could see they're more vocal, but they haven't been around as long. So McCann's the guy to me that could be a real glue to this clubhouse to really make sure the things are going right.
Sure.
And he would be a good, I think the more and more I'm looking at this, and I know I'm reading everywhere that the writing's on the wall, he's gone, he's gone, he's gone. I don't know. I'm coming around to say there's more value with him on this team than there is shipping him out, paying for his contract, or at least a half of the contract. There's more value of that money on this team in the clubhouse as a DH. And I kind of hope that happens.
What about the aspect, though, he might not be happy with being the DH? And if he's not happy, he's probably not going to be a good leader in the clubhouse.
Yeah, see, I don't know. He just doesn't come across as that guy to me. He comes across as a guy that's...
But he's never had to deal with a situation where he hasn't been the everyday catcher. And I mentioned last week about the contract situation. He loses $15 million bucks for not catching.
That's for next year, right?
An option on the last year of his deal,
which is 18?
2018,
right?
Where he does not get that option picked up if he doesn't catch. It might actually be 2019. It is 2019.
Okay, so that's what I thought it was, which leads me to believe that next year means nothing in that contract, right? 2018 is the time.
Yeah, but if he's an everyday DH next year, no one is gonna put him back at catcher for 2018.
Potentially, but he could also boost his value as a designated hitter and in theory could do something
that money up anyway.
Exactly.
Yeah, I just
don't see him as a guy that's going to cause problems. He seems like a very team guy, a guy that wants to win ball games. He's a gritty, old school type of guy, and I just don't see him causing the problem. It's not his personality, and I don't see anything that leads me to believe that he's going to be some kind of a diva saying, "Oh, if I'm not going to be happy, I'm not going to be the guy that's producing or that's helping the younger guys on the team." I just don't see him as that. I think everything outside the dugout stays outside the dugout with him.
I would agree with that. I think he is that type of personality. And if he does really want to embrace the leadership role, he could mentor Gary Sanchez and Austin Romine. And who better? I mean, he's been one of the best catchers in baseball over the last 10 years. So I think there is real value in that. I would just like to see if he does embrace that role, because it's not a definite, it's not a certainty. All right, let's move on to Tanaka. I got on Tanaka last week and I said that I don't trust him. And what did he do? He went out there and shut me up. It was a big game in Seattle on Wednesday. Not only is Seattle ahead of them in the wild card standings, but it was the rubber match Wednesday afternoon in Seattle. And Tanaka went out and shut him down. He didn't have his best stuff because he gave up a couple hard hit balls in the first couple innings, but he did get through 7 innings, 6 hits, and no earned runs, which obviously is a shutdown start. And the Yankees were able to win the game. I think they won 5-0. Tanaka on the road trip didn't allow a run. He pitched 7 2/3 in Anaheim, no runs, and then 7 innings in Seattle, no runs. And the reason I kind of said I didn't trust Tanaka is because of his performance in games similar to that one on Wednesday this season. And I recall the game in Houston when they were going for the sweep before the trade deadline. He gave up 4 runs in 5 innings, which is certainly not good enough when you're the ace pitcher. The Yankees lost that game. And then the other one, which I've mentioned a few times, was against the Mets at Citi Field right after they traded away their players. Tanaka went out and got shelled, gave up 6 earned runs. But this time, he nutted up. He stood up and shut down the team. And I kind of have to give him credit for that. I mean, scoreboard, right? The scoreboard tells me the facts. And the fact is Tanaka pitched really well.
You know, this is the guy that you didn't trust. You gave you gave 50-50, I think, right? When we were talking about 50-50, he's going to do it.
In a big game, I feel 50-50 with Tanaka on the mound, which is not how you should feel with your ace.
Right. Yeah, the fact that he came back out and pitched very well over the past two is tremendous. I mean, there's little room for error at this point in the season. So to me, every single game moving forward is a huge game. I mean, for the Yankees, every game now is a playoff game in essence. And because you can't falter at this point. You cannot lose a couple games in a row, 3 games in a row, or you're out. And the fact that he needs to be the stopper, he needs to be the guy that pitches well to you know, in that situation in Seattle to win the series, a 3-game series, not a 4-game series, to win that series, he came out. And I don't know, you and I feel differently about him. I think over the entire, you know, our opinions are similar in the sense that he's not the prototypical ace guy. I think I have more confidence in him than you do just to keep the Yankees into a game. So here's, I'm just happy he shut him down completely. That was a big start, and that was a big pitching performance.
Here's where you and I agree on Tanaka, though. He is the Yankees' best pitcher. He is their default ace. However, you could name 10 aces in Major League Baseball that you would probably take over him, correct?
I don't know about 10. No, I don't think I can name 10. I mean, you look around the league. I've seen Madison Bumgarner over the past month has not been pitching very well either.
Okay,
but there's guys who struggle at the same time. So
trade
no,
right now, right would, now on the table, 1-for-1 Tanaka Bumgarner. For Bumgarner. Are you doing it?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay.
But I'm not, What I'm saying is that there are points where aces will not perform like an ace.
Sure, of course. I mean, Clayton Kershaw is the best pitcher statistically in baseball, but he goes out in the playoffs and you don't have a ton of confidence in him. So I understand that, but everyone has their faults. But I think with Tanaka, he has more faults than the average ace.
I just believe that Tanaka, in a big start in a playoff game, I have confidence that he's going to keep this team in a game, if not pitch very well. And to me, that means a lot. I think that's a huge thing for the team behind him, knowing that you're going to get a good start from him. Maybe he's not going to shut them down completely, but you're going to get a good start. He's going to keep you in the game, and it's our job as an offense and defense to play well behind him to win the game.
You just hit the nail on the head with the offense. And I think a big part of it was this year that the offense was so bad that even if he went out there and pitched 7 innings and 3 runs, which is a pretty good start, the Yankees would lose 3-1. And you look at it and it's like, well, Tanaka didn't do his job. He's the ace. He needs to match the other pitcher for pitch. But it's sometimes hard when the Yankees offense is going up there 0-7 with runners in scoring position. They go down 1-2-3 so quickly in the blink of an eye every inning. They don't even get guys on base sometimes for long stretches. So the offense does play a factor in the pitchers as well. You have to perform on offense sometimes and it boosts the pitcher. And right now the Yankees are going out scoring over 5 runs a game over the last month. Before that, they were scoring 4 runs a game. So that makes a huge difference.
I mean, winning is absolutely infectious no matter what position you're playing. The other thing about the offense that's such a critical part to a pitcher is that because the offense was struggling so badly during the majority of the season, Tanaka's got to go out there knowing that he's the number one guy and has to be absolutely perfect almost every day. That's a lot. If you're trying to be perfect on every single pitch, chances are you're going to leave a pitch up. There's no room for error at that point. And when you're a pitcher knowing that every single time you come out, you might not be able to do what you want all the time. You may not be able to throw the pitch that you want all the time because of the fact that you can't give up a solo home run. You gotta be perfect on with every single at bat. And that doesn't allow, to me, the pitcher to use his full range of an arsenal.
I did find a stat that supports my argument, though.
Of course you did. How long did it take?
I dug deep. I'm not going to tell you how long I searched for this stat. I went to the ends of the earth on Baseball Reference, and I found that Tanaka in high leverage situations is allowing a .292 batting average.
Okay, so what defines a high leverage situation?
So there's a long, in-depth definition of it on Baseball Reference, but essentially, it's points in the game, it's pivotal points in the game that changes on that single at-bat or that single play the win probability of your team.
Oh my God. I want to know what nerd came up with that stat.
It's a good stat, I think, because basically what it is it's the seventh inning and there's two outs and it's a tie ball game and Tanaka gives up a solo home run. That's a high leverage situation that he did not perform in. It's situations like that. I understand it's me going out and searching for a stat that supports my argument. But it does back up my argument that in big situations, he can't always be trusted. Because in low leverage situations, he's allowing like a .202 batting average. So it's almost 100 points higher when the pressure is on.
All right. I don't even think I can give much conversation to this stat. It's so deep and ridiculous.
It's not ridiculous.
It is, because you don't know what these high leverage situations were.
Yes, I do. I just
specifically.
Explained.
No, you gave me a textbook answer for what they were, but show me in the games what those were. And
all right, next week I will.
Yeah, I want to know like what that high leverage situation was. To me, that's some nerd in his mom's basement trying to find something.
When the win probability of the game changes, when the momentum in the game shifts hands, Masahiro Tanaka is at his worst.
I guess maybe that's real.
That
probably
is real.
Not though. No, I don't know. 292. How many at bats is that? 5.
No.
6 at bats.
No, it was over.
7 at bats.
It was over 100 at bats.
Oh, come on.
Yes, it was. It was over 100 at bats. I'll look it up right now.
We'll come back to this next year or next week. This is something that's just too much buried. The fact of the matter is now they're winning, they're playing well, and he's pitching well. That's what I care about. He's pitching well in high leverage situations in the season, and he just came out with 2 dominant starts.
96 at-bats.
That's high leverage to me.
96 at-bats.
Great. So add in every single at-bat that's over the past 2 games to that stat as well, because to me, those are high leverage.
That's involved in there.
No, it's not.
These stats are up to date. I looked them up this morning.
So you're saying that in the first inning, the first batter is also part of that high leverage situation?
Well, no, that's a low leverage.
Why?
Because it's...
The games are high leverage.
Even in playoff games,
high leverage.
Even in playoff games, there's low leverage situations.
No, I see. That's something that can be completely argued. I don't believe that. There are zero low leverage situations in big games. Zero.
Okay, so in a big game, it's the fifth inning and your team is winning 9-0. That's a high leverage situation.
Yeah, it can be, absolutely.
Oh, come on.
Absolutely.
All right.
No, it's not a low leverage situation. Is my point.
Yes,
not
it
everything.
Is.
The fact of the matter
the
is when you're
cannot when shift. When no matter what that batter
does. But it
does,
can. Momentum can absolutely shift
okay,
in
so
any game.
He gives up a home run, now it's 9-1.
I'm pretty sure the Yankees had a 6-0 lead recently and blew it. Was that a low leverage situation when the first run scored and then all of a sudden 6-8 runs scored after that?
Well, the first batter when it was 6-0 was probably a low leverage situation, yes.
Not to that guy. Not to that
Speaking
team.
Speaking of Swarzak, who is no longer on the team.
I'm just saying, it's a very arbitrary number. It's not
arbitrary, though.
The fact that you're saying high leverage is arbitrary. Yes, it is.
Well, that's what it's categorized.
It's their definition.
As.
They made it up. It's like going to the
every
Wikipedia
stat in baseball.
Believing everything.
Every stat in baseball is made up. That is the whole point of baseball. It's a bunch of statistics that we make up because we're nerdy. That's what baseball.
No, the statistics are real. It's the categories that the nerds put them in are made up. That is what's made up.
You see, you want to stuff me in a locker, is what you're saying.
Yes.
All right, moving on. Can I bash the manager? Is that legit or is that off limits?
No, he's got these guys going pretty well. Got them going pretty well.
But
I think I'm going to agree with you, though.
Yesterday's game, Saturday's game, the Yankees are winning 12-4, cruising. Elgary Sanchez is hitting home runs. Starlin Castro is hitting home runs. Even did Chase Headley hit home run yesterday or was that Friday? I can't even remember. Regardless.
It was when he was DHing. It was Friday.
Friday. Okay, regardless. It's an 8-run ball game, and Girardi goes to Adam Warren and Tyler Clippard. And I tweeted out, why the hell are these two guys pitching in this game? And everybody responded, they need work. They need work. They haven't pitched in 5 days. They need work. Blah, blah, blah. I understand that. We looked it up. Adam Warren didn't pitch since the Anaheim series. So I understand a week off is too long for a bullpen guy. You probably got to get him in there. But do you really have to use Tyler Clippard, who pitched on Wednesday in Seattle and who you made the great point, had not faced Baltimore this season? It just doesn't make sense to use two of your three best relievers in a game that's 8 runs just because they need work. You don't know what's going to happen Sunday. What if you need to use Tyler Clippard for 5 outs today because it's a 1-run ball game, or you need to use Adam Warren for an extended period of time because it's an extra inning game? I just hate wasting bullets in 8-run games.
I agree with you. I understand the fact that some of these guys, and Warren's the guy, I think, you know, pitching one of them is something that can be looked at because they needed work. Warren hadn't pitched in a while, so I could see that. And you know, the fact that Clippard had not pitched against the Orioles to me is an even more supports the fact that why we're I'm not saying I'm upset about this. I just question it. I just scratch my head sometimes. It goes back to last year with scratching my head with some of the moves that Girardi makes at the end of the game in the bullpen. And the fact that he, and people are like, okay, well, he's been in the major leagues for a long time. There's a lot of tape on him. People have seen him. I get that. That's fine. But the fact that a team has not seen a guy in a season to me makes a difference because there are going to be some big games coming up against Baltimore. Still, we still got to go to Baltimore to play them. And the fact that they hadn't seen Clippard to me can make a big difference in one guy's at bat. You feel more comfortable when you see a guy more recently and, you know, making this Baltimore lineup any more comfortable than they already are, any more, you're giving them any more advantage to, you know, the fact that they're extremely talented and they've been playing amazing this year is something that I don't want to do. So, yeah, I can understand the Warren move. I don't get the Clippard move in a non-high leverage situation.
Well, Girardi went into that game with the mentality he was going to pitch them regardless of the situation. So
yeah,
no matter what happened
that?
In that game, no. But I know
just,
that's
just,
what he
it's
did.
It's in the binder. Yeah,
it's in the binder because they haven't pitched in X number of days. No matter what the situation is,
right.
They're getting in the game today. So yeah. Because 8-run game might as well have been an 800-run game. If you're pitching your two of your best relievers in an 8-run game, you're going to pitch them in any sort of situation. So
yeah, no, I get it. And it's the Clippard thing is to me head scratching. Warren even more, just because he's not really just a one inning guy all the time. He needs that work. I think he needs to get his arm some game action. Clippard is a I definitely would not have pitched Clippard yesterday.
Because you would like to, if on Sunday you're going for the sweep against Baltimore.
It's a huge sweep. You've got to sweep.
If you have
too.
A one-run game in the sixth inning, why not? Wouldn't you like to have maybe 9+ outs from those three guys today? Yeah. I absolutely would. I don't trust the rest of those bums in the bullpen.
Especially with CeCe pitching. I mean, you know CeCe's going to probably give you 5 good innings, right? He's going to keep you in the game for 5 innings at least. That's kind of been his MO. He's pitched a little bit deeper this year, but you know, I mean, if you're going into that game, you're thinking 5 from CeCe, right? Like that's to me what I'm going in with. Like this is what we're going to get from this guy. Anything else is gravy.
Right.
So
that's
you need those.
A lot of outs.
You need
to
those
get.
Guys. Yeah, you need those guys at the end of the bullpen.
All right, let's move into some mailbags. We got a lot of good mailbags this week. So let's start it off with Taylor at Big Wanky on Twitter.
Is that like Wanky, like Chris Wanky? Is he a Florida State fan?
I have no clue. Why don't you ask him? He says, what are the chances we see Jordan Montgomery called up this year? If you do not know who Jordan Montgomery is, he is ranked as the 20th overall prospect in the Yankee system by MLB Pipeline. Left-handed starting pitcher. They drafted him in the fourth round in 2014. He's a big dude, 6'6", 23 years old. He's a little hefty, which I kind of appreciate. Hefty lefty. And he's had a very good season. This has kind of been his breakout year. He's approaching his career high in innings. He's averaging about a strikeout per inning, which is pretty good for a starting pitcher. And mysteriously, I'm saying that kind of sarcastically, his fastball jumped 2 to 3 miles an hour this year because he was clocked always in the low 90s. Now he's cranking it up 93, 94 this year consistently.
I mean, I think that also happens with just maturity of the
Absolutely.
Of the body, even, you know, 23 years old.
Yeah. I said it sarcastically.
Yeah. 23 years old. You're still growing. A lot of guys are still growing and they're, you know, getting used to the way that they pitch. They're getting stronger. So this is not something that's unexpected. And yeah, I mean, there's an absolute possibility for him. I mean, if you're looking at when the rosters expand, and this is something that we're going to get into as well within this question, because it's coming up this week, the rosters expand September 1. Montgomery is absolutely a possibility. You know, Girardi's going to want more lefties in there. And, you know, right now we're looking at like Richard Bleier coming in or, you know, guys like that. The fact that Montgomery's had some success is positive, and he's definitely going to be, I think, on the short list for guys to come up. The only thing that would prevent him, in my opinion, is if they're worried about the innings and if they think that he's just already thrown too much at this point.
Well, that's why he's not going to be in the starting rotation, which is obvious anyway, because they have 5 starters who have been going pretty good. Green and Sessa, I think, are there for the rest of the season to see what they've got. And I think that they would even go back to Severino again before they go to Montgomery for a start. But he could absolutely be a lefty out of the bullpen for an inning or two in September.
Yeah.
Not exactly going to trust Chase and Shreve anymore.
Blyer, Shreve. I mean, who else is coming in? This is a guy that would might be looked at.
So, yes, he is on that list of September call-ups for pitchers. And you know what? A lot of times September call-ups are also to reward guys. He's had a great season, and they want to reward him with a couple major league checks. Here's your first big league action. I think that's a real possibility for him.
I don't think that's going to be played into this year, though, with the guys coming up. I think rewarding a guy, I think because this year is so unique in the fact that the guys that come up in the September call-ups are probably going to play a lot more than they have played in the past.
Of course, even when you reward a guy who's had a great season in AAA, you with the understanding they could get into some game actions. I mean, you have such a what are the rosters expand? I don't even know what the number is. There's a crazy number of players to go through on teams when rosters expand that, I mean, everyone can play, but they're not going to play a lot because you have only so many positions on the field.
Right. Well, and that's why I think he'd be a bullpen guy or maybe, you know, a mop-up duty dude. But again, if it's something that they're worried about, the fact that he's already thrown career highs in innings, we've seen guys come up and struggle after they've kind of hit that point. I mean, Chase and Shreve last year, and he hasn't been the same since then. So who knows if that was something that's led to his demise. I don't know, but they're going to be careful. They've always been careful with guys like that. So it wouldn't surprise me if they didn't because of that reason.
As far as position players go for September call-ups, obviously we're going to see Ref Snyder. I say there's a good chance we see the flow man Ben Gamel as well. But I'm not sure who else really. Obviously, there's the whole 40-man roster trickery that you have to play around with when you're making these call-ups.
Yeah, there's going to be a couple outfielders that come up for sure. Gamble, I think, is going to be up. And then when you're talking about pitchers, the interesting one to me, the most interesting one, is the guy that just came back, was optioned off of the 60-day DL to AAA, Brian Mitchell. He came back a lot faster than I think most people expected. He had that toe injury.
No, four months. That was exactly what it was.
I think when we came into this, when that happened, I didn't think we were going to see him at the end of the year. That was the rehab. I don't know if we were expecting to see him back, though, at the end of the season. I definitely wasn't. I thought they were going to take their time with him and not throw him. But the fact that he came back at the end of the AAA season and they did put him back on the roster leads me to believe that they are going to call him up when the rosters expand, as long as he's feeling okay.
Yeah, I was a little skeptical of that because the guy hasn't pitched all season. Why risk more injury to him when he hasn't pitched all season? But you're right. What other reason would they have activated him at the end of the season? He made the team out of spring training. He had a great spring. It really sucks that he got that toe turf injury. I think Mitchell, though, is a guy that competes for the rotation in spring training next year, which is also what Montgomery could do. Okay, this next mailbag comes from James B. on Twitter, and he says, who is more likely to be traded in the offseason, Gardner or Ellsbury? If one is traded, can Frazier be on the opening day roster and compete for a spot in center field next season?
So we're talking about the two guys being traded first, the Gardner or Ellsbury. Ellsbury's not getting traded. That's just what's happening.
I mean, Ellsbury's contract
is, yeah, it's too big. Nobody's going to take it on. The Yankees are going to be sitting with Ellsbury. Gardner, I do not see on the team next year. There's just too many outfielders ready to come up, and I think they're ready to move on from him. I just don't see that happening. Frazier is one of the guys that's obviously one of the highly touted ones in AAA. He's going to be competing, but I think Frazier's a guy who they want to see in another season in AAA, at least half of a season, and prove that he can light up AAA before he comes up to the majors.
Well, okay, first of all, in Gardner, it kind of sucks that if they do try and trade him this offseason, which I agree with, they will try. It's coming off one of his worst seasons in recent history versus last season, which was one of his best. He made the All-Star team. So you're
first
selling...
First half.
It's still, he's an All-Star. When you look at the numbers for the entire season last year, they're pretty good. And when you're going to look at the numbers this year for the entire season, they're going to be pretty bad. His on-base percentage is much lower than it normally is, so you're selling low on him. But at this point, you probably need to move on from Gardner. And sneaky, Aaron Hicks has also been playing himself into a job next season. So he's a cheaper option than Gardner, obviously. Speaking of Frazier, he's 21 years old. So there's going to be at least another half season in the minors, I believe. Even if he lights it up in spring training next year, I still think they send him to AAA to work on some stuff. After he got off to a very hot start in his first couple games with Scranton, he has struggled a little bit. He got demoted in the lineup. He's down in the sixth spot now. He was batting second. And this was basically a demotion for performance. And Frazier, I read some comments where he agreed with it. He said, you know, I'm not performing in the second spot, and that's not helping the team win. Overall this season for Scranton, he is batting .222, and he struck out 24 times in 22 games. So not terrible, but certainly not worthy of getting a call-up or potentially being on the opening day roster next year.
I mean, the power hasn't really been there either. He's got, the last time I looked, he had just hit his first home run, so I don't know if he's come back. So he hit another one. I mean, .222 is not good. It's not, I'd say it is pretty terrible, actually. 24 strikeouts in 22 games. That's, I think, one of the more alarming things. I know they want to cut down those strikeouts for him, especially a guy that's going to be going gap to gap. Really got to cut those strikeouts down. And I think that definitely at least a half season, they're going to want him seasoned. They want him performing much better at the AAA level before. And I agree with you. Even if he does have a tremendous spring training, I think they're going to, you know, he's going to start the season in AAA one way or another, just because there's too many guys that have performed ahead of him in AAA, and they're really not in a big hurry with him at this point. I think they want to make sure that he's right and he comes up and isn't a chance to succeed and not a chance to, you know how the Yankees are with keeping the, you know, mental state of their prospects in a good place. Severino's really tested that theory, but the fact that they want him to succeed when they come up is an obvious sentiment. So they, I think they are going to keep him down there. So I don't think he's really a guy that we're going to look at early in the season next year.
All right. What do we got next for questions?
So next we have Tommy underscore Glover on Instagram. Do you think Ref Snyder will be included in a trade package with Brian McCann? And we're going to combine a couple other ones with that just because they're along the same lines. This one's from Bronx Bombers News on Instagram. What will the Yankees get back for Brian McCann when he goes to the Braves, or if he goes to the Braves, who will be included? And then Nick Jackis, also on Instagram. Do you think the Yankees will sign a starter this offseason with Eovaldi going down? So appreciate the Instagram questions, too. I know we throw that up every Thursday for questions on Instagram. If you are on there and you want to give a question for the mailbag section, just hit it in the comments. But yeah, there's going to be a lot of interesting things happening this season, the offseason for sure. And I think, unfortunately for me, just because I'm a fanboy, Rob Refsnyder, I believe, will be looked at by other teams. And I think is a guy that, you know, given value in a trade, that Brian Cashman could look to move in the offseason. But, you know, we talked about Brian McCann and how I think that there is a lot of value for him next year. Again, the Yankees would have to be blown away, in my opinion. I only want them to be blown away, which they're not going to, you know, in parentheses, they're not going to be blown away for a trade with him. So I think, and I kind of want him to be on the roster next year. So,
well, any trade that involves Brian McCann, I don't think will involve another player from the Yankees, because it's going to involve the Yankees eating money. So I don't think they're going to be willing to send a player plus eat money plus give them Brian McCann. That right. doesn't seem like it would be logical. Unless a team is sending a decent player back, but again, that doesn't seem logical. So Brian McCann, if he is traded, seems more of like a dump of 80% of the salary or whatever it may be.
See, that makes me even cringe more when we're talking about if we're getting as high as 80% of a salary dump. I'm like, don't do it if that's the case. Don't. There's no reason to do it. I see there is a role for him on this team. There's just
right.
There's
We've an absolute established role. That, but yeah. But if they're trying to get under that luxury tax number, or they're trying to open up spots for other guys, it might be worth it to them,
I guess.
This question from Nick on Instagram, he says, do you think the Yankees will sign a starter this offseason since Eovaldi is down? God, I hope not. Because if you look at the list of free agent starting pitchers, it is a pile of dog shit. Here's some of the notable guys that I found on the list. Brett Anderson, who's 29. Gio Gonzalez, who has a club option, which he could still remain with Washington. Rich Hill, who's 37.
He's 37?
Yeah.
Man, he got old fast.
Matt Latos, who I believe you hate.
He's a train wreck.
And Jeremy Hellickson. Those are like the guys that if the Yankees sign them, I don't think would be the biggest disaster in the world. It would be a disaster, but it wouldn't be the biggest disaster in the world. There's a number of other guys on that list that are complete trash that I don't even want them to go near. The free agent starting pitchers this offseason was going to be highlighted by Strasburg, right. But Washington locked him up earlier this season.
You might have left the best pitcher off this list, though.
Yeah?
Yeah, big boy. Bartolo.
Oh, Bartolo. Yeah, I know. I was going to put Tolo on there, but I feel like if he is going to pitch again next year, it's going to be with the Mets.
The headliner of the free agent starting pitching class.
45-year-old Bartolo.
I guess Gio Gonzalez is the name you see out of there that probably sticks out. But, I mean, he's really underperformed since he's left Oakland. He has not been the same guy since he left Oakland.
He had one really good year in Washington. He's due to make $12 million on that club option next year.
Right.
That it might be kind of worth it for the Nationals to pick up. Because you're probably going to have to pay him that plus long-term anyway.
Yeah, I think that's a contract that they're going to pick up, that the $12 million for a starting pitcher, a lefty, where he's probably, what, they're 3-4? Actually, no, not all these young guys that come up. He's really pushed down 4-5.
He is, but he's kind of a known commodity for them. So
yeah, so I think they'll pick him up. But yeah, the rest of these guys, like, stay away from Latos. I don't think Latos is pitching again in this league. I mean, he's just proved that he can't be in a clubhouse.
I wanted to throw him in there because I knew you hated him.
Yeah, he's a thug.
But the list of free agents is garbage, and that's kind of a good thing because it means the Yankees are going to stay out of it, and that's exactly what I want them to do. The Eovaldi injury certainly hurts the rotation next year. Not that Eovaldi was performing fantastically, but he was at least locked in. And the one thing I wrote about this last week, that Eovaldi was going to be in a contract year next season. And we know how players rise to the occasion during contract years. So not only do the Yankees miss out on that benefit, but also Eovaldi misses out on having a year where going into free agency, he can cash in. He's probably looking at a non-tender contract offer from the Yankees. He's got a rehab. He's most likely not going to pitch next year. So kind of sucks all around for Eovaldi and the Yankees.
Yeah, it's, you know, the one thing about the free agent market for next year, I think we're going to see something very similar as far as an approach to what Cashman took this year. When you don't see a guy that you really want to go after, I mean, there may be reports going into January that the Yankees for the second straight year have not signed a free agent, because this is an area, especially with the minor league system completely bolstered at this point, and something that Cashman, I think, has done on purpose. I think that the trade market might be the way that they go for starting pitching, if they are going to add a starting pitcher from outside the club. That's the way that I believe that they can get probably the most value. And the fact that they have a lot of depth in their minor league system right now, you're going to see some of these guys get traded away. It's just going to happen. And you look at the numbers, you look at the positions that are available in AA, AAA, and in the majors, something's got to give with a couple of these positions. And I think that Cashman's going to, you know, turn some of these guys eventually, maybe not this offseason, but eventually into a starting pitcher.
So you kind of just answered the next email question from Travis. He says, do the Yankees make any moves this offseason? And if Torres continues to play well, what do you think they do with our infield prospects, assuming second base would be the only opening in the near future after Castro, or if Castro is moved? You kind of just touched on it, and we touched on it earlier in the show. You're absolutely right about the depth in the minors, and that's the beauty of acquiring all those players, that you can, if you want to make a play for a big name starting pitcher, you got depth in the minors. You're not trading away your only two good prospects at that point. You're trading away two or three of your prospects. It's a totally different ball game with what Cashman has been able to do with this minor league system.
Yeah, and you know, there's some interesting things about it as far as like who's going to come up and who's blocking them, I guess. The question was directly about Torres as well. I mean, having him come alive, and you know, I don't think that Torres has any bearing on anything they do. Like, no. Zero bearing on
ride that wave
him
while
playing
you can.
Well, and the infield prospects. To me, that has nothing to do with it. Yeah, Torres is a utility guy. That's what he is. And the fact that he's playing right now is a complete and a direct result for him being hot right now. I mean, this is not a guy that's going to be in the long-term future as far as a position, you know, a steady position on the Yankees. He's a utility guy.
If they want to get crazy with the free agent relief pitchers, on the other hand, there are some good names out there. Obviously, Chapman, everyone remembers, he kind of alluded to the fact that he would be open to coming back to the Yankees. And the fact that he's pitched well in Chicago. But I thought it was funny when they played Smack That Bitch Up.
Why do you even play that in the first place?
It's a horrible song to play at a stadium anyway.
Doesn't that lead you to believe that it was intentional? Because why would you play it anyway?
Kind of seems like some intern in the Wrigley Field clubhouse is getting a little tricky.
Yeah, see, because that's not on the playlist in the first place.
Right.
So
that's
why
not
is
on
it
the
there?
Approved list of songs. No.
Exactly. So someone did that.
It does seem fishy. And yeah. I mean, obviously, that's not going to have any bearing on where Chapman goes in the offseason. He's going to go to the team that pays him the most money.
Right.
But the Yankees could decide that they want Aroldis Chapman back. I don't, at this point, I wouldn't say I want that to happen, but I don't think I'd be upset. There's also Wade Davis out there, but he's got this injury with KC. There's an option out there on his contract for $10 million. But does KC want to pick that up, considering he is going to be probably ending the season with an injury? And also Mark Melancon, who is used to be on the Yankees, came up with the Yankees, is also a free agent. And there's another number of other relief pitchers who are free agents that if the Yankees want to make a splash in free agency, I feel like that's where it would be this offseason.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting to do. I mean, if your theory about the Yankees trying to unload contracts to get under the luxury tax number, then Chapman's probably not in play at that point, right? Because,
well, they'd have to also unload Brian McCann and pretty much all of it. And then you'd pay
exactly all
then
of
you'd
it.
Pay the money that Brian McCann is making to Aroldis Chapman.
Right. But I don't even know if it's going to be enough, because you're not going to get a team to take that much off of his contract.
Well, so, I think you could get, say you're on the hook for $4 million, $4 or $5 million of Brian McCann. That means you still have $12 or $13 million to play with for Chapman. That's, I mean, you're not going to pay a closer more than that.
It'll be interesting. The numbers are probably close, I'd say,
when
you're talking about Chapman and bringing him back. But yeah, I mean, this is a guy that they know brings, you know, a lot of electricity into Yankee Stadium. I think that's something that they're really trying to do. They know that the kids are getting the fan base excited. And, you know, you bring a guy like Aroldis Chapman back into the back of the bullpen, and you got Betances Chapman for, you know, years in the back of the bullpen. And that's exciting. That's something that definitely brings butts in seats. It makes the eighth and ninth, you know, must-see baseball. And you couple them with L. Gary, and that's a hell of a battery right there.
All right, next question comes from MDevo116 on Instagram, and he says, Tyler Austin came up as a third baseman, so do you think they will give him a shot there? And I'm assuming he means this year. I know Torres has come alive lately, but Austin gives more power in that position. I looked up Tyler Austin's minors career, 119 games at first base, only 35 games at third base, and 319 games in the outfield.
So when you're talking about 35 games at third base, you're looking at Rob Refsnyder numbers almost. I'd say they're pretty comparable.
Yeah, I mean, well, Refsnyder's played much less than that. But yeah, I mean, you think that Tyler Austin has a lot of third base experience, but that's actually not the case.
Right. So, I mean, there's a potential there, but most likely not. I mean, in a pinch, possibly, but Torres has definitely gone over there. With Refsnyder up, they might be able to put him back over there. I doubt it, just because they've seemed to be sour on him as a third baseman. So, you know, he hasn't shown the pop yet in the majors. We need to see. I think they need to see a little bit more of him to really see that the power numbers translate into the major leagues. I mean, obviously he got off to that huge start with his first at bat with going back to back with Judge. That was awesome. He's struggled since then. You haven't seen the power, and he's a guy that's I don't know, almost been seemed to be overmatched a little bit so far.
I want to ask you a question. Speaking of Judge and Austin hitting home runs in their first at bat, do you think that's kind of a curse? Would you want to hit a home run in your first major league at bat?
Yeah, absolutely.
You don't think that every time you go up there, you're trying to live up to that?
No.
It would be interesting see what players in major league history have led off their career with a home run and what those guys have done throughout their career.
Yeah, that would be a fun thing to
look
at.
Marcus Thames hit a home run off Randy Johnson.
Yes.
I'm trying to think like off the top of my head who I can remember. Oh, I don't know if Andrew Jones did. Daniel Nava, do you remember him for the Red Sox? Hit a grand slam in his first career at bat. I know it doesn't really mean anything, but it'd be interesting to see. Judge has struggled a little bit. Tyler Austin has struggled a little bit. On the other hand, Gary Sanchez didn't have a home run for the first 9 games, and look what he's doing.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't think any of that stuff is related. I think that they've been overmatched their first week, 2 weeks up. And I think it's just exciting for that thing. I think it goes away after that, you know, after that game, it's done.
Yeah. You probably ride the high for that game.
You look at a guy like Judge and even Austin, when you hear them interviewed and you just hear them speak, it doesn't seem like they, at least, you know, talking about it, it doesn't seem like they get too riled up in a certain moment. They seem pretty level headed and they seem like guys that, you know, can ride a high and a low pretty well. So, you know, hopefully Austin starts seeing the ball a little better and is able to start performing better. And, you know, we've seen Judge. I mean, Judge has been striking out quite a bit, but we knew this was going to happen in the beginning. I think everybody, I mean, even look at AAA. When he first came up in AAA, he struggled and he made his adjustments and he got on top of it and really started succeeding. So, you know, I think that's what they're looking for. They're going to see a dip and then more of a, you know, a steady rise for these guys to make their adjustments and to be able to play in the major. So I'm looking forward to that.
All right. What do we have next?
So the next one is from Matt Tucker. He says, are the level of prospects received from the Pirates for the Ivan Nova trade tied into his performance? He is now 3-0 and the Pirates won his other start that he started since the trade. I hope this is the case. Thank you.
And I don't know if you saw, but he also pitched a complete game his last time out.
Yeah, he likes Pittsburgh, apparently. He's been pitching well.
That Cervelli connection.
Maybe.
All right. So the player to be named later, this was, I thought, a really interesting question because I thought I knew the answer. I did know the answer, but it was still interesting to read about the whole stuff about player to be named later. Yankees got two players to be named later for Nova. And do you remember I gave Cashman a lot of credit for getting two players for the crappy Ivan Nova? Well, like we said, he's done well in Pittsburgh. So what is a player to be named later? It's basically when two teams can't figure out a player to trade at that moment, but they don't want to hold up the overall trade for that team. So they just agree to trade a player in the future. It has to happen 6 months down the road, and it's based on a list that's agreed upon when the trade happens. So to answer the question from Matt, the players who the Yankees could get from Pittsburgh is already pretty much agreed upon between Cashman and Pittsburgh. It's probably a list of 5, 10, maybe a couple more guys that the Yankees would accept back in a trade for Ivan Nova. But unfortunately, it does not make a difference if Nova goes out and gets injured in his first start, or if he pitches lights out, or he gets crushed. I thought it was interesting to sort of see the whole workings of the player to be named later.
Yeah, the fact that it takes 6 months to make that trade, or has to be done within 6 months, is interesting, because I guess you're looking at your roster at that point, or whenever they decide to come back to the table. Chances are, in this case, it's going to be after the season, and they're going to look to see at the players and where they are, their minor league system, and then choose the best one. So it makes sense, though. I mean, I don't know, unless there were contingencies in a deal like this, which I'm sure there could be, that some kind of a contingency in a deal that's made behind the scenes, it makes all the sense that the players are already agreed upon, because isn't that what you're trying to do? Aren't you trying to get the best out of a trade? And why would you be penalized if a guy succeeds? I mean, that's what you're trying to do. So you shouldn't be penalized in a deal if your guy, the one you think has potential, comes out and proves that you're right.
Do you think it maybe has an effect psychologically for GMs? If Cashman is saying, well, Nova for you won 5 games down the stretch, I want to get a lot for this trade. Not that he can actually do that, but do you think maybe it happens subconsciously for the GMs?
What do you mean? Like when they're negotiating, or they're talking about the players to be named later, 6 months down the road?
Yeah. So say in November, the Yankees go back to Pittsburgh and say, time for you guys to pay up on that trade. And right. No, look at Nova's stats. He's 5-1 with a 3.2 ERA. That's pretty damn good. I want, you guys got everything you wanted out of this trade. I want to get something back good.
But I don't think the players already agreed upon it.
Right. But what I'm saying is, does that affect Cashman when he goes back to the phone to call the Pittsburgh GM? Does he say, well, I want the two best players on this list that we agreed upon? Because it doesn't have, the Pittsburgh GM doesn't have to say yes. It's just, it could be those players.
See, that's where I'm confused about that, because agreed upon is two parties agree upon this list. Anybody from this list, two of them, you can have.
But the other GM still has to agree to do it.
He did.
No, it's not that Cashman can then just select any two from that list. Cashman says, I want player one and player seven from this list. And the Pittsburgh GM can say, nope, I'll give you player one and player five. And Cashman says no, because there's been deals where they can't agree.
And the guy gets sent back?
The guy gets sent back. That happened in 1981. Galdon was traded from the Yankees to the Mariners in 1980 for a player to be named later. And then they couldn't agree on a trade, so Seattle sent him back the next season.
So that makes more sense if there's still negotiations that went on. I was in the understanding that that both teams agree that these players are on the table, and at a given time,
they're on the table, but they're not solidified. In other words, Cashman can only select from that list.
He can only negotiate from that
list.
He
can only negotiate from that list. That's a better word, not select. He can only negotiate for players on that list.
Yeah. Okay. Well, then it absolutely does go into it, because, when we first started talking about this, I thought there was no negotiation. I thought the negotiations and all of the, all of that stuff was done already.
No, it's basically like Pittsburgh GM was like, listen, Brian, I don't have time to deal with this right now. Just give me Nova, and here's a list of 15 players that we can negotiate for within the next 6 months.
Right. Well, then, yes, it absolutely goes into the mindset of Brian Cashman going back. Depending on it. So I actually think that it is tied. the level of prospect, I guess, was already agreed upon for that list. But to answer the question, it still does matter what his performance was. if there's still negotiations to happen.
Yeah, but what I guess I read the question to be, is Pittsburgh obligated to send back better players, which they're right. not.
Yeah, unless there's some stipulation that we don't know about that was agreed upon.
Well, what the interesting aspect is, if they can't agree upon a trade, which I think they will, I don't think it's a big deal, Nova is a free agent, so Pittsburgh can't send him back.
Yeah, interesting.
I also want to mention, do you remember the Trey Turner player to be named later fiasco?
Yes.
Where he was drafted by San Diego, and then there was a three-team trade between the Padres, Rays, and Nationals. The Nationals were going to get Trey Turner. Will Myers was going to go to San Diego.
Right.
But they couldn't physically trade Trey Turner at that point because he was signed as a pro within the last year. And at that point, it was 2014, there was a rule in baseball that you couldn't trade a player until 1 year to the day after he signed his first pro deal. So even though Trey Turner was the agreed upon player, he was the player to be named later once he was eligible to be traded. And it was 6 months down the road. So he was basically in limbo in the San Diego minor league system where he wasn't really a Padre, but he was playing for them.
Yeah, that's because there's so many stupid rules in baseball with the amount of time served and, you know, all these things that go into it for control of a team. There's a lot of really dumb rules in baseball. But
well, that rule was nixed because MLB realized it's a dumb rule. So you now can trade players the day after you sign them.
Yeah, and he's turned out to be a hell of a player, too. That's the guy that the Yankees were definitely keying on for Washington if they were going to look at a trade for Andrew Miller. Trey Turner was definitely a guy. Him and Giolito were the two guys that were circled, I believe.
Yeah, the trade didn't really work out for San Diego, that whole rebuild the organization, remember, when they brought in Will Myers and Matt Kemp and Big Game James and whoever else.
Who did Washington give up in that trade?
I you know what? I remember reading it and I did not recognize his name.
Yeah, man, they made out like a bandit.
So that's the whole player to be named later thing. Kind of interesting. It's like you said, it's interesting when you read into all these different things with baseball. And it's like, I consider myself a huge baseball fan and there's so much stuff I don't know that I have to read about and figure out. Kind of cool. So those were all the mailbags. Thanks, guys. A lot of good mailbags this week. Before we get out of here, though, I want to talk about Blake Rutherford. This kind of came through in the last couple days, and it kind of flew under the radar, but he has not played in a game since August 24th. He was having a very good season, his first season in pro baseball for the Pulaski Yankees, single-A affiliate, 351 with three home runs. He's already skyrocketing up the Yankees prospect list, and he's ranked in the top 100 for MLB prospects. We talked about him during the trade deadline stuff, so good stuff on Rutherford. And then let's play detective a little bit because some weird stuff's going on. August 26th, Blake Rutherford tweeted, "Trust it," and with a baseball emoji. And then a day later, August 27th, at 11:11 p.m., the Pulaski Yankees tweeted, "Regarding Blake Rutherford, the Pulaski Yankees have no comment. All questions may be directed to Yankees Player Development Complex in Tampa." People were retweeting it. They were saying, "What the hell's going on?" At 11:52 p.m., so about 40 minutes later, that tweet was deleted. And we don't know what's going on because the Yankees Tampa player development has not made a comment. Rutherford has not appeared in another game since August 24th. So it's a little bit of a mystery what's going on with our boy Rutherford.
Yeah, this has been two players in the past month and a half that have been just very secretive, like something's going on. We don't know what it is. But the first one was Jacob Lindgren. He stopped pitching and nobody really he wasn't on an injury report. He just wasn't throwing and nobody really knew what was going on. The Yankees are very, very hush hush, I think, at the lower levels about what happens. Obviously, the Pulaski Yankees are not owned by the Yankees. They're privately owned. So they don't have, you know, quote, control over the players. So they really can't comment on the players. All comments go through the Yankees in Tampa that, you know, they're the ones that will actually comment about their players. So it's interesting. I don't know what there's been no talk about an injury. There's been no talk about him moving anywhere. So I don't know what's happening. Is he getting a bump up for the playoffs to get an extended look somewhere else? And maybe there's like a game limit. I don't know.
Here's what I think happened. Like you just said, the Pulaski Yankees can't really comment. But they were probably getting bombarded with tweets saying, "Why the hell isn't Blake Rutherford playing?" And some intern or somebody who runs that Twitter handle was finally like, I'm sick of this. I'm going to tweet, direct all your questions to Yankees player development in Tampa. And then somebody from the Yankees organization was like, you can't say that. Please delete that tweet. And I'm sure some intern, summer intern was fired because of that tweet. But that's exactly what I think happened.
Well, I mean, that doesn't change the fact of what's going on with Blake Rutherford.
No, I mean, who knows what's going on with him?
That's the key. I mean, I don't really care what the intern commented and the fact that, like, he just did, whoever did that caught.
Why? I think
just,
that's fun.
Yeah, but they brought attention to something that maybe
exactly.
was going under the radar.
Mayhem, chaos.
But the fact
Some
of the matter
just
is,
watch the world burn.
I want to know if there is an injury with Blake Rutherford and they're just being hush hush about it, because that's exactly what happened with Jacob Lindgren.
I know.
There was an injury that nobody talked about and nobody knew about.
Why
and then all of a sudden
hush,
he's down for the year.
Unless he's injured and they don't know what the injury is yet. That's
because they're
being
always
hush hush.
They don't need to say anything. It's the Belichick factor. You know,
no,
you don't
it's
why,
not that, not, it's not
why
the
say anything
for a guy in single A ball.
They don't want to cause alarm. I don't know. Because if somebody gets hurt, that's another guy that just got hurt. That would mean two of their last draft picks are now hurt. They're two number ones.
I just got a mental picture of Brian Cashman going to the podium and acting like Belichick about questions.
I could see him being Belichick like that.
No,
just being
Cashman
very quiet.
Has always been open. Cashman's always been pretty open.
I could see him just
honest.
Start mumbling under his.
I would love it if Girardi turned heel and started doing that.
That would
every,
be pretty funny.
Every answer, it's not what you want. It's not what you want.
Yeah, I'm going to be keeping an eye on this, though, because Rutherford's a guy who got off to a really hot start, and you thought was a guy that's going to be definitely in Tampa next year and has the potential to start climbing the ranks relatively fast. So hopefully everything's good.
We'll keep an eye on
it. It's just some weird thing that's going on.
Yeah, we'll keep an eye on it. Update on the podcast next week. He has not tweeted since August 26th. Trust it. That kind of makes it seem like he was foreshadowing what happened, where, like, trust the process or whatever it may be. That's kind of how I read it. But it's interesting, and we'll follow that story. Thanks, everyone, for the mailbag questions. As I said, you can follow us on Twitter. Follow the show on Twitter at Yankees Podcast. On Saturday afternoon, I was tweeting from the podcast. I think I'm going to start doing that a little bit more, try and grow that follower base. Follow me on Twitter at Yankees_talk. Follow Scott at Scott Reinen, and follow the website at Bronx Pinstripes. Any final words, Scott, before we get out of here?
Yes, one final word about the fan shop. Check it out. I've put on Twitter some teasers about the new shirt that's coming out, Rebuild the Empire. I love it. It's one of my favorite shirts. I'm pretty much going to be refining the design all week. We have it going on pre-sale. You're listening to this Monday. It actually started on Sunday, the pre-sale. So go and grab one of those tees. You'll see some other tees coming out very soon that have to do with El Kraken. So keep an eye out for that as well. There's some good ones in the works. But yeah, go grab the Rebuild the Empire. It's perfect. It's beautiful.
El Gary. I am Gary. He is Gary. We'll talk to you guys next week.
Hey guys, thanks for listening to the Bronx Pinstripe Show. Make sure you find us on iTunes and subscribe so you can get all new episodes directly onto your phone. If you do like the show, we'd love for you to take a minute and give us a 5-star rating and review in iTunes. It really helps us out and allows us to create more shows. We're on Twitter at Bronx Pinstripes and the same on Facebook. You can always find us there talking Yankee baseball. Thanks again, guys, for your support. Really appreciate it, and go Yankees.